Hello and welcome to History by Hollywood, a podcast series that examines the real events and people behind fact-based movies. This is episode 67, part 1, for Sunday the 15th of December 2019, and this week's movie is 1999's The Insider, about tobacco industry research scientist Jeffrey Wigand and his whistleblowing exploits. My name is Martin Darlington, and with me as ever is Andrew Bliszczyk. Hello, Andrew.
Hello, Martin. How are you?
Yeah, very good. And this is quite timely as I enter into my fourth month of not smoking. So, I'm now a big fan of Jeffrey Wigand.
Okay, well, let's start, as always, with any updates and errata. I don't think we've got any of them, but we've got some reviews. The website historybyhollywood.com has been updated with some reviews, and also the planned episode page and the about page have had recent overhauls to drag them up to speed. The first of our reviews starts, "No radio, few sports." It's a 5-star review in Apple Podcasts by Simon Barr from the UK, and on November 26th of this year he wrote, "Since finding Somehow, this podcast, I find I no longer listen to the radio or many of the umpteen sports podcasts I have in my library. I started with films I knew and have now gone on to watch previously unknown ones, and it's all your fault. Amazing range of films and research, so well put together. I think an episode on one of my favourite films ever, A Man for All Seasons from 1966, following the relationship between Henry VIII and Sir Thomas More, would be of real interest to your listeners." Now, we've had this one come up before. I think it's one of your favourites too, isn't it, Martin?
We have, and we'll get, because Simon also emailed us, so we'll respond to that when we get to Simon's email.
Okay. So thank you very much, Simon. The next review, again in Apple Podcasts, is titled Top Listen, and the review's by Ricardo Bobby, again from the UK, who on the 25th of November of this year wrote, "Great podcast, informative, entertaining and educational, new take on ingesting history. Needs to revive the long format podcast though, the whole multiple part thing doesn't work for high information volume. Take a leaf out of the Joe Rogan, Dan Carlin playbook." End of review. Do you want to comment on that? I didn't know the Dan Carlin and Joe Rogan, but they're prolific and popular podcasters from what I can tell.
I don't know Joe Rogan, but I do listen to Dan Carlin. You can wait months and months and a 4.5-hour episode will land. It's a fair point. The main reason, Ricardo, that we changed was we just simply didn't feel able to continue to produce reasonable quality shows at the frequency we had been doing. Both Andrew and I have experienced recent upturns in our day job demands, and it was a choice of either doing this format with regular weekly production of shorter episodes, or keeping the episodes at one per movie but having longer breaks in between, which may well have become irregular because there are some movies, I mean, like Gladiator, we didn't really have to do that much in-depth research because we were so familiar with the subject, whereas things like The Insider, I knew virtually nothing about. So it's something that we agonised over. We did choose this path. We're very open to suggestions, feelings and requests. The one request we're not in a position to satisfy is that we go back to one full episode every fortnight. And we're sorry about that, but, you know, this is a hobby we do, and therefore real life that earns money and pays the mortgage really needs to take priority. So I think for the time being, we'll persist with this, but we will listen to feedback. And if it becomes overwhelmingly that people would prefer one big episode, maybe we drop to a monthly output and do that. I don't know, but
yeah, that's what we discussed.
What I really like, though, despite the misgiving over the new format, is Ricardo still gave us 5 stars, so that's hugely appreciated, and thank you.
Thank you very much, Ricardo. So back to reviews and feedback, and we're going to hear now from Simon Barr, whose review we heard a moment ago. As Martin mentioned, he also emailed us and repeated his request for A Man for All Seasons. As we replied to Simon, it's definitely a worthy film, winner of 6 Oscars, including Best Actor for Paul Scofield, Best Picture and Best Director for Fred Zimmerman. It's also timely for Martin because he's been watching the BBC's adaptation of Wolf Hall, a historical novel by Hilary Mantel, which very much takes the side of Thomas More's nemesis, Thomas Cromwell. the former Moore, a diehard Catholic, and the latter Cromwell, a similarly devout Protestant, have been portrayed as hero or villain depending on the teller's personal bias. As pointed out in a recent comparison of the two men and their portrayals on the book, on books and on screen, historical fiction needs heroes. History, however, doesn't. So it's definitely one for us in the near future. So thank you, Simon, for the reminder about that great movie.
Yeah, I mean, it's a fantastic movie. Paul Scofield, I mean, I'm not quite sure, having seen him in two or three films, and probably more than that without so much taking note, but certainly the Best Pick podcast, which will Dr. Phil had mentioned to us, they've just recently done Braveheart, which was hilarious because they really didn't like it. I mean, much less than us. But these are cinema insiders, and they examine all the movies in a random order that have won Best Picture. When they talked about Paul Scofield, I said, why is he not talked about in the same breath as Laurence Olivier and Alec Guinness? You know, he was such a great actor. And it's a great film, but it very much takes a sympathetic view of Thomas More, and more, not revisionist, but maybe more balanced examinations of his life have painted him as pretty much a nasty piece of work, quite happy to burn heretics, as he saw them, who was anyone who wasn't Catholic. So yeah, but definitely a movie for us to do, and a fascinating chance to try and look with an objective perspective at those periods.
And any comment from you on the BBC's adaptation of Wolf Hall? I haven't seen it, but it was very well reviewed. I think it's Damien Lewis.
Damien Lewis plays Henry VIII,
yeah, okay.
And the wonderful Mark Rylance plays Thomas Cromwell, very much played as a quiet, humble, you know, and he was from humble upbringings, Thomas Cromwell, which is one of the reasons he put so many noses out of joint. I think he was, from what I've read, the real Thomas Cromwell was more pugnacious and combative than Mark Rylance's portrayal, but it's good. It's not a rippingly fast yarn. It's quite not sedate, but yeah, it sounds like I'm damning it with faint praise. It's fascinating without necessarily being gripping. But then I'm only two episodes in. I've been diverted by other stuff. Now, before we move on, I do want to also mention, because I haven't got the notes, so whilst I remember, because I'll forget otherwise, we did hear from my good friend Jules Cheesek, the composer of The Waltz of Anachronism, our theme music, and with whom I've just recently recorded a monster episode of Motopod, the bike racing podcast. And I know Gary Shavitz listened to it because he's emailed us. Hi, Gary. But Jules is a huge fan of Ennio Morricone, the composer of the music for The Untouchables. And he felt we were a little bit dismissive of his score. I don't think we were necessarily, and I think it's great music, but it was commented in a few of the reviews we read that, oh, it's not his best work. And I think Jules is very keen for people to understand that he's best known for The Good, the Bad and the Ugly, spaghetti western score writing, but actually he's done an awful lot of stuff, and The Mission, which we mentioned in one of the supplementaries about the Jesuits in South America with Robert De Niro and Jeremy Irons. Brilliant film and wonderful music. Really, like, you know, as good as any John Williams or, I'm trying to think, you know, Hans Zimmer, Thomas Newman, Vangelis. You know, he's right up there with those superlative score writers for cinema. So there you go, Jules.
Thank you, Jules.
We are doffing our caps to Ennio Morricone.
Okay, so we've got a couple of more comments from listeners. Doug Moore wrote in to recommend The Imitation Game, but sadly this is so far from the real events that happened at Bletchley Park, Alan Turing and his wartime code-breaking team, that its best hope it might be included in one of the Ones That Got Away supplementary episodes. Doug's other thought was Tolkien, about the author and his early life. The movie has been disavowed by Tolkien's estate and gets a hammering from critics, scoring only 51% positive on Rotten Tomatoes, with audience rewarding it a more respectable 75%, but it's unlikely to be making its way to top of the HBH History of a Hollywood shortlist. So sorry about that, Doug.
Yeah, as I replied to Doug in an email, I listened to a completely separate podcast where they happen to have the GCHQ historian. GCHQ is the General Communications Headquarters or Government Communications Headquarters at Cheltenham in UK. It's our equivalent of the NSA, you know, the listening people. And they had their historian on at this podcast, and they asked him about the Imitation Game. He said, well, they got two things right. There was a Second World War, and there was a man whose name was Alan Turing. That's about as far as it goes. So, yeah, it's been largely discredited as far as historical accuracy goes. Our weekly input from Dr. Phil, Dr. Phil Pomerantz, and that's in no way said sarcastically. It's wonderful to hear from so many people so often. Dr. Phil mentioned the Italian anarchist bombings in the US that we mentioned at the beginning of, remember when we were talking about at the beginning of the Untouchables, when the bomb goes off and we were wondering, did they have sophisticated timer bombs in that era?
In the mob.
And yeah, and I'd said there was a prominent Italian anarchist I was trying to remember the name of. Phil suggested it might have been Nicola Sacco and Bartolomeo Vanzetti. They were convicted and executed in 1927 for armed robbery, which involved murder, but they were suspected by many to have been executed more for their political views than any actual involvement in the crimes. I did some digging, and actually the person I was thinking of is Luigi Galliani, who was a leading Italian anarchist in the US around that time, but he'd been deported back to Italy in 1919. But his followers, who did include Sacco and Vanzetti, continued to practice Galliani's ideal of political violence until 1932. So thanks, Dr. Pete, much appreciated. And did we mention Christina?
I don't think we did Christina Doxton.
Yeah, we've been asking for ideas about movies that feature South African figures or themes to give us a good excuse to get Des Latham back on. And Christina came up with Cry Freedom, which I can't believe. It's a film I saw when it came out. Now, this is a biopic of activist Steve Biko and his friendship with white journalist Donald Woods, played by Denzel Washington and Kevin Kline, respectively. A really good film. Definitely one up to put up alongside Invictus as a South African theme movie for us to cover soon. Like Invictus, very American in the stars and the directorial, the director and the like. In fact, I can't remember who directed Cry Freedom, but it's a... I remember it being a really, really powerful film when it came out. So that's jumped straight onto the list, and we will definitely look at that. And we'll speak to Des and see where his interest and his passion lies and what he thinks of them. And we'll, between us, we'll pick one. Because I'm thinking Zulu Dawn is just looking a bit niche. It would be a personal indulgence for me to do that one, because I like the film, but it would appear that not many other people do. So. Uh-huh.
Well, Des has got an affiliation with the movie, having grown up in the area where the filming took place when he was a younger lad. So he'll have an association with it as well. Anyway, I really appreciate Christina's suggestion. It's completely forgotten by us and a good movie, apparently. So well worth putting on the list.
Yeah, and as we go into The Insider, I should point out that the score was written by Lisa Gerrard and a guy called Peter Bork. And Lisa Gerrard, people will know her voice. She's the hauntingly wonderful singer who features in the Gladiator song that's at the end when he's being buried and everyone carried off. And she sort of sings in a made-up language, so it's not actually words. But she and Peter Bork made what I must say, being a bit harsh, entirely forgettable music for The Insider. There's nothing really that you remember. So for the intro for this, I'm just having a little bit of fun, and everyone can try and guess what the connection is, and it's not very difficult, but anyway, you can probably hear some whistling in the background. So with that, let's get on with the story of the movie.
Okay, The Insider was released in 1999 and tells the story of biochemist and tobacco industry whistleblower Jeffrey Wigand, played by Russell Crowe. cast goes some way to explain the $90 billion budget, as it featured Al Pacino, a 60 Minutes investigative producer Lyle Bergman, and veteran actor Christopher Plummer as journalist Mike Wallace.
It's 90 million.
What did I say?
Didn't I sound like billion?
Oh, I beg your pardon, 90 million.
I think that would be a world record, 90 billion.
90 million was a fair bit 20 years ago,
yeah.
Too. So, but yeah.
Yeah.
It was directed by Michael Mann, who already had a string of hits to his name, including Last of the Mohicans, Manhunter, which saw the first cinematic incarnation of Hannibal Lecter, Heat, possibly the best cops and robber movie ever made that Martin has seen, and Martin can wax lyrical about the gunfight sequences of Heat. And he would go on to do more after The Insider, including Ali, the biopic about Muhammad Ali, starring Will Smith, which is also definitely on our long list.
Yeah, I mean, the thing about Heat, for military veterans, the thing that really stands out is when they have gunfight scenes, they have a realistic amount of magazine changing, because you've got normally 20 to 30 rounds in a assault rifle magazine, and they go very, very quickly, especially if you're firing on automatic. And you just see these movies where, you know, the never-ending belt of ammunition or magazine, and they actually employ proper tactics. And one of the reasons was they had a technical advisor called Andy McNab, who was an ex-SAS soldier who wrote a book about his exploits in the first Gulf War. And they took it very, very seriously, apparently. So that's and it's De Niro and Pacino, so.
Uh-huh. Well, I think you pick up doing some research on Insider that Michael Mann is a very serious director. He takes the job very seriously, and he strives to be as accurate as he possibly can, which I guess is a bit of a preview of what we're going to talk about when we get to the movie itself. And that obviously shows out in the way he did the gunfight scenes in Heat.
No, absolutely. And I suspect he's someone who, when he watches it and that's someone else's movie, and he'll sit there and go, well, that's not how things happen. Come on. You know, you can make it dramatic and at the same time make it realistic. He wrote the movie alongside Eric Roth, and it was largely based, or at least inspired by, a Vanity Fair article written in May 1996 by Marie Brenner entitled The Man Who Knew Too Much. If you search for that, The Man Who Knew Too Much, Marie Brenner, the article can be found, and it is fascinating. It's quite long. It's like 23, 24 sides of A4. The movie was very well received by critics. It was nominated for 7 Academy Awards, 5 Golden Globes, but it didn't win any. Interestingly, though, Russell Crowe was one of the nominees for Best Actor, and this started a run of 3 consecutive years in which he was nominated, the following year for Gladiator, which of course he won, and again for Beautiful Mind in 2002, which he didn't win. So not only did he get a hat-trick, we have now covered all 3 of those movies, Gladiator being episode 1 and A Beautiful Mind being episode a bit later. just to have interest, in 2000, the year that The Insider was up against or was competing, Best Picture, Best Director and Best Actor were a clean sweep for American Beauty, which I've never seen. But
Sam Mendes,
Kevin Spacey, Kevin Spacey playing, isn't it? He has a slightly inappropriate relationship with his daughter's friend or something.
Yeah, well, he has a midlife crisis first, and tries to reclaim his manhood in a very obvious and creepy way, I guess.
Yeah, how prescient.
Yes. Despite the critical response and the equally enthusiastic audience responses, it's got 96% positive critics response and 90% positive audiences on Rotten Tomato. Not enough people went to see it, apparently, and from the $90 million budget, only $60 million was recouped from the box office receipts. I do remember seeing it at the time when it was released, and I was very impressed, and I'm surprised to hear that it wasn't a financial success given the amount of buzz it got at the time.
Yeah, I mean, it's quite possible. I heard a movie insider's explanation for why it might have bombed, and he said too many people thought it was going to be specifically about the tobacco industry, so non-smokers didn't care, and smokers didn't want to know. They didn't want to be told, you know, which may be true. Al Pacino, I know, has been asked about it, and he said it's one of the projects with which he really enjoyed and he's proudest of, but he said it is a long movie. I mean, it's nearly 3 hours.
Wow.
But I, when watching it, I didn't feel that. Now, I watched it in two chunks because it was taking me a look, because I kept pausing to write notes, and I can touch type, but not that fast. I had to keep pausing. So it actually took me about 6 hours to get through it all. So I did it in over two evenings.
I watched it in three chunks, and I was painfully aware that it was, you know, going into it, that it was 2 hours and 47 minutes or something. But you're right, I forgot that very quickly. And even though I watched it in three sittings, it definitely doesn't feel like it dragged at all, despite being such a long time on the clock.
No, I mean, it's, you know, there's no car chases or gunfights, or there's it's not thrill so much, but there's tension definitely. Yeah. But it's a slow build up tension. It's just one of those movies that you have to sit down and pay attention to. You know, it's not a let's go to the cinema, get some popcorn and sit there and, yeah, it's all right. You know, be entertained. You are going to be entertained, but it's got real depth.
And preempting the end of the podcast a bit, but it's definitely worth a watch, isn't it?
Oh, yeah, absolutely, for sure. And the performances, again, you know, Russell Crowe, whatever people think about the reputation that he's got over the years as a slightly prima donna-y type of actor, he's just so good at portraying, you know, I mean, we've seen him do Maximus in the Gladiator ring, where he's this action hero, but one with a bit of depth to him. But he can also do the John Nash and the Jeffrey Wigand, the quiet, sincere, slightly conflicted character. And one thing I think this movie does, they're all human. They've got egos, they've got fears. You know, he's not an absolute crusader. He's scared. But as somebody once said, without fear, there's no courage. Courage is the overcoming of fear. If you're not feeling any fear, you're not being brave. You're either stupid or you're just supremely confident. But that's not being brave. That's just probably being unaware.
Yeah, and just on Russell Crowe's craft, I read somewhere investigating this movie that the director, Mann, he limited the meeting between Wigand and Russell Crowe to only three sessions, because he wanted Russell Crowe to retain some kind of spark of originality, because he does a pretty good job of physically and the tone and his voice of Jeffrey Wigand. He nails a lot. He looks a lot like the real Wigand at the time, and sounds like him a lot, with the slight southern intonation in his accent. I watched the original 60-minute interview that features in this, and they got it shot by shot right, and Russell Crowe does a really good job, as you say, portraying the everyman under immense pressure.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. I mean, we could go off down a rabbit hole. I was just thinking about accents, and why, obviously, 90% of the movies are made for an American audience, first and foremost, and why in things like Gladiator, I can't remember who it is, but there's someone in Gladiator who actually speaks with a discernible American accent. It might be the prefect of the Praetorian Guard. I can't remember who it was. And apparently, American audience said, well, that's not very realistic. I'm thinking, well, why is speaking with a British accent seen as realistic, representing a Roman, and speaking with an American accent isn't? I mean, would it have mattered if Russell Crowe had spoken with an Australian accent? It's all suspension of disbelief, you know.
I guess so.
But if you had someone speaking English with an Italian accent, that would be as close to realistic as you could get. But I'm sure we'd go, what? Why is he playing a mafia guy?
I mean, there was a lot of criticism of The Hunt for Red October when that came out, and it starts off on a Russian submarine, and Sean Connery starts speaking a few words of Russian, and then they quickly zoom in on his mouth and zoom back out again, and suddenly he's speaking English. So they're, you know, trying to get a little bit of authenticity, and off he goes, speaking with his Scottish accent, playing a Russian submarine captain. I thought that was probably a good call, just, you know, acknowledge that he can't do accents and won't be able to speak Russian, and just let him talk in his own voice.
But I mean, Sean Connery can only speak in his own voice.
Exactly, acknowledging reality.
I'm not sure we mentioned it, but our good friend Gary Shavit did write in and say, are you sure it's an Irish accent he's trying to do? Couldn't he have not just been, you know, Jimmy Malone? That could be a Scottish name. But no, it's supposedly he's trying to be an Irish beat cop in Chicago. So, yeah.
Anyway, let's move on from the Untouchables and get back on track with The Insider. Shall we start with an examination of the movie?
Absolutely.
Okay. The opening scenes, we see a blindfolded man being driven in an old car with gunmen in the back of a following pickup truck. We see posters of Ayatollah Khomeini on the streets, and so we guess that this is Iran or an Iran-supported state in the Middle East. The man is delivered to a house where a bearded, turban man speaks. He asks why he should grant an interview to an American reporter. From the voice, although his blindfold remains on, so it's hard to recognise, we realise the guy being transported in this clandestine manner is Al Pacino's character, Lowell Bergman, who is the producer for the current affairs programme, 60 Minutes. He's trying to get an interview with the leader of the Hezbollah movement, and the person that he's trying to get the interview for is journalist Mike Wallace, a veteran who joined 60 Minutes from when it first started. The sheik with the turban finally agrees to an interview and then he leaves, but he slips away before Bergman gets to see what the fellow looks like. The next scene, we cut to a lab where we see a man packing up his briefcase to leave for the day. This is Russell Crowe's character, Jeffrey Wigand. He drives home to a large, well-appointed house where his wife is on their patio and his daughter is watching TV. He pours himself a drink, his wife comes in to greet him, and they hear their daughter cry out. There's an older daughter, probably 8 or 9 years old, and she's having an asthma attack. Wigand starts up a medical machine and an oxygen mask and calms his daughter down. Clearly this is a well-practiced routine. The family are eating their dinner and Wigand appears tense. He offers to drive his daughter to her dance class the next day. His wife asks if he doesn't have to go to work. He avoids the question, but later, pushed by his wife, he tells her that he's been fired. She immediately asks what they're supposed to do, listing healthcare, car and house payments as the first priority. He says that he's gotten a severance payment, which includes cash payments and the continuation of their health coverage. Shall we continue, or
yeah,
that's reality with the two key protagonists of the movie, I guess, the producer, Lowell Bergman, and the whistleblower himself, Jeffrey Wigand.
Yeah, from comments that the character says, Lowell Bergman, I'm not sure they were posters of Ayatollah Khomeini. They may have been posters of the sheikh that he met, because he does mention later on, he said, I'm not quite sure why they blindfolded me. Everybody, you know, his posters are all over the place. But he's a confident, punchy, go-getter news reporter. The only thing that's different is he didn't actually wear a blindfold in reality. He was born in 1945. He'd been a pioneering investigative reporter from the late 60s. He contributed to Ramparts, a sophisticated left-wing paper, the San Francisco Examiner, and then he became an associated editor at Rolling Stone magazine. In 1977, he co-founded the Center for Investigative Reporting, and then in 1978 began his TV career, working as a producer, reporter, and then executive in investigative reporting for ABC News. In 1983, he joined CBS News' 60 Minutes program, which we mentioned earlier, where he would spend 14 years breaking tough stories, landing tough interviews, including with the leaders of Hezbollah, as depicted in the opening sequence. Equally, Jeffrey Wigand is equally accurately portrayed. He was head of research and development at Brown & Williamson, who were then America's third largest tobacco company. He was earning $300,000 a year, which in the mid-90s was a lot of money. He was fired after just over 4 years with the company due to constant clashes with bosses over their continued use of additives to improve flavour, despite Wigand's warnings that the additives were carcinogenic. They'd recruited him in 1989 to develop a safer cigarette, but within a year, B&W had scrapped the idea and continue to make their products more appealing and addictive, much to Wigand's disgust. He argued throughout the period he was with the company, and when he wrote directly to CEO Thomas Sandifer, who we'll meet later on, in early 1993, he was sacked for a difficulty in communication. One of his few requests to the producers of the movie was his daughter's names should be changed and his elder daughter's medical condition should be changed, and both of those were. In reality, his wife in the movie is called Leanne, but in reality, her name was Lucretia, which is an interesting name to give to your daughter.
Yes, but I think what you're setting up for is that the portrayal of these two guys and the circumstances that they're being presented to us are very accurate, and I think that might set the tone for the rest of the movie. But let's see. Back at the action, we're in the Middle East again with the Sheikh, and we meet Mike Wallace, the veteran reporter played by Christopher Plummer. They're trying to arrange two chairs, but one of the Sheikh's minders, who's armed, is angry that Wallace is sitting too close to the Sheikh for the recorded interview. This leads to an angry exchange that between Mike Wallace and the armed minder, and Lowell Bergman, Al Pacino, has to intervene and calm the situation down. Wallace's interview then starts, and right out of the gun, his question is confronting. He says, "Are you a terrorist?" And as the interview continues, we cut to a parcel being delivered to a house in the US. The parcel turns out to be Bergman's house, where he's on the phone to the news contacts. His wife is on another phone as their teenage son leaves the house. We get a feeling that this is a house full of go-getters and achievers. Bergman has opened the box that was delivered, and he sees it's been sent anonymously, and it's full of technical papers that he initially believes refer to Philip Morris, a rival tobacco company. He calls a contact. He says, "Is there someone that can interpret these scientific documents for him?" And that contact gives him Jeffrey Wigand's number. He calls Wigand and speaks to the wife, and the wife tells Bergman that it doesn't want to talk to the media. She hangs up, but he immediately calls back, and we see Jeffrey Wigand in his home office hearing the message that Bergman is then leaving on the answering machine, trying to get him to play ball and help decipher some technical tobacco result documents, I guess, research result documents. A fax immediately arrives on Bergman's fax machine in his home office, I can't talk to you. They then exchange a series of hand-scrawled notes via fax. As Bergman asks, "Can't talk? Won't talk? Don't want to talk?" To which Wigand responds, "Can't, won't, don't want to." He calls to leave Wigand another voice message saying that he'll be in the lobby of a particular hotel in Wigand's town at a certain time, and he'll be the man reading the New York Times, leaving it open for Wigand to reach out to him if he so chooses.
Yeah, and well, the town is Louisville, Kentucky.
Yeah, Louisville.
Louisville. So on the reality on that, I mean, they're spot on. The interviews with the Sheikh did take place, although the precise details, whether there was an argument or not, is unclear. There was an arrival of a box. It was from a Philip Morris employee sent to Lowell Bergman, and it had technical language such as ignition propensity, which he thought, okay, I need an industry expert to interpret this for me. And that is how he started reaching out to a contact who said, "Oh, I've got this guy, Jeffrey Wigand." Now, the reason that that Lowell Bergman's contact knew Jeffrey Wigand's name is he'd started getting involved with some anti-tobacco lobbyists, and he'd also started doing work for the FDA, the Food and Drug Administration. So his name was already out there as someone who might help with anyone taking on the tobacco industry. In truth, and the movie isn't far away, Lowell Bergman did keep court. Oh, sorry, I've got some cat disturbances in the background there. He did keep getting through to, he said, a woman's voice, he assumes it was Mrs. Wigand. She'd say, "He isn't here," or, "He can't talk to you, he doesn't want to talk to you." So in Lowell Bergman's own words, he pulled the reporter's midnight trick. He called after midnight, where people are going to be asleep, and he got through to Wigand, and he said, "I'll be in the lobby of the Seaback Hotel at 11 a.m. Now, the way they meet, we're about to come on to, that's slightly dramatised, but, okay. Yeah.
So we cut straight to that hotel lobby, don't we?
Yeah.
Okay, we see that Lowell Bergman is in the hotel lobby, he's reading the New York Times, and then we see that Wigand has arrived too. He makes out who Bergman is, but they don't talk. The two get up and they walk towards the elevator together, and they both ride up to Bergman's room. The next scene, we're in Bergman's hotel room as coffee is being delivered by room service. Bergman assures Wigand that when someone talks to Bergman in confidence, it stays that way. Wigand challenges him and he asks how a radical journalist from Rampart magazine ends up at mainstream CBS. Bergman explains that he still does the tough stories and 60 Minutes reaches a lot of people. Weigand then looks at the thick dossier of leaked information that Bergman has brought, and he says that it's a fire safety and smoking study that he can easily translate into layman's terms, but it's from another company, but that's as far as he'll go. In other words, he won't talk about his previous company. Weigand reveals that while he no longer works where he used to work and asks what he'll get paid, he's told that this sort of a gig usually gets between $10,000 and $12,000, and then he says, okay, he'll do the translation of the science. He tells Bergman that he worked as head of research and development at Brown & Williamson Tobacco Company and was a corporate vice president. He leaves, and Bergman's looking thoughtful at the big fish that Weigand used to be. What's become of him, and why has he lost this prestigious job? We then see Mike Wallace presenting the show on Syria, Israel, and Hezbollah. Bergman rushes out of the studio to catch up with a lady, a research assistant called Debbie, and he asks her to examine Kentucky state law and the constraints of a confidentiality agreement.
Do you want to, should we just wrap up the reality bit on that side? Yeah, Bergman says that when they did meet, he'd left this message about the lobby. He said at precisely 11 a.m. he saw the portrait of middle-aged anxiety stood before him. So I don't think he suggested they go for a cup of coffee. I don't think it was quite as clandestine as the movie shows with the newspaper and getting in the lift. Weigand was paid around $1,000 a day for the work in translating the documents, which was fairly standard apparently. And it was about work being carried out by Philip Morris, which then, and I think still are, the world's largest tobacco company, to develop a fire-safe cigarette. Because that was another concern about people falling asleep with a cigarette in their hands and setting fire to themselves. And they called it the Hamlet, as in to burn or not to burn, which is kind of, you know, someone in the industry had some humour. So, as we mentioned earlier, during this period, Jeffrey Weigand was also doing confidential work for the FDA. When they asked for documentation, when the FDA asked for documentation for tobacco companies, the standard industry tactic was to drown them. What that involved was delivering tons of paperwork to Washington, knowing that the FDA staff wouldn't be able to trawl through all of it to find the relevant bit. What Weigand was able to do was guide them on what specific papers they needed. So that was the value of his work for the FDA. So, should we go back to the movie?
The action? Okay.
We meet Thomas Sandifer now, don't we?
Yes, we see. So we've got Al Pacino and his character trying to do something about Kentucky state law to see if they can get Weigand out from his confidentiality agreement. We then see Weigand with his ex-boss, Thomas Sandifer, played by British actor Michael Gambon, who reminds him of this confidentiality agreement that he signed. So there's this clear threat about what happens if Jeffrey breaks the agreement. Weigand assures Sandifer that he has no intention of revealing anything that he has agreed not to. Sandifer then produces a supplementary agreement, and he tells Weigand he needs to sign this additional restraint, confidentiality agreement, or his severance payments will be stopped, and they'll take further measures against him. Weigand's response is that it had never occurred to him to try and F Brown and Williamson over, but if you're trying to F me, well then F you. So he has a very violent reaction to the suggestion that he's going to sell them out, and he's protesting because he's a very honourable guy, even though they're still trying to put the screws on him.
It's almost one of those things of, if you hadn't mentioned it, it would never occur to me, but now you have, you know, possibly a foolish thing to do.
Perhaps to a tobacco company, but anyway. Outside, we see him get on a payphone straight away, and he calls Bergman out, and who's at dinner. Bergman's at dinner. He roars to him that he's been sold out. Bergman has no idea what he's talking about, and he appears very baffled, but we don't see the repercussions as the scene cuts straight to nighttime, where Jeffrey is blowing off some steam at a golf range, hitting golf balls under the lights. There's only one other golfer there at all at that night, and strangely this guy's in a business suit as he also hits a bucket of balls. Weigand looks over to the man, and the man stares back. There's some clear intimidation going on here, as the man doesn't even try to hide his interest in Weigand. They leave the driving range, and at their cars, Wigan tries to confront this guy, but he just drives away. Then we get to Wigan's house. In pouring rain, he's loading his daughters into the car when Lowell Bergman arrives, protesting that he didn't tell anybody that Wigan was working with 60 Minutes. He also says that he knows Wigan has something big to tell him. Wigan tells him to jump in the car, as it's morning the next day, I think, and jump in the car, I'm taking the girls to school. They park after dropping the girls off. He tells Bergman about the expanded confidentiality agreement that Brown and Williamson were trying to get him to sign. And he says that he's agreed to sign it as he needs to protect the medical coverage for his family, especially given young Deborah's asthma condition. Bergman takes all this in and then invites Wigan to talk to him outside the bounds of the agreement, like where he used to work. Nothing to do with Brown and Williamson. We learn that he worked at Johnson & Johnson, Union Carbide in Japan, and that Wigan speaks Japanese. He also worked for Pfizer, and all these previous employers are health-related. Wigan is explaining about an example of corporate responsibility and how James Burke, the then CEO of Johnson & Johnson, pulled painkiller Tylenol off the shelves across the entire country the instant that there was a problem identified with it. Someone had tampered with it, and rather than argue a case, he just pulled the entire stock off the shelves across the country. Against this, Wigan talks about the Seven Dwarves, a nickname given to the CEOs of the main seven tobacco companies in the US, and how they all swore to a congressional hearing that they had no knowledge about nicotine addiction. Bergman then asks Wigan why, given that he's a scientist whose background is in health, he ended up at the tobacco industry at all. Wigan is a bit evasive at first, but he admits that he thought he could do some good. His research could be beneficial, but admits that mainly he took the job because it paid a lot of money. Bergman assures him that he's doing nothing wrong, making money to look after his family, but if he has knowledge of harm being done to the American people, then he has a conflict, and the only person who can resolve that conflict is Wigan himself. We then see an infamous TV clip of tobacco chiefs denying that nicotine and cigarettes are addictive. Shall we examine it?
Well, we've got a clip, and this is the actual congressional hearing, a recording of the actual congressional hearing with the congressman who's chairing it, asking the CEOs to specifically clarify their position on nicotine and addiction.
Let me begin my questioning on the matter of whether or not nicotine is addictive. Let me ask you first, and I'd like to just go down the row, whether each of you believes that nicotine is not addictive. I heard virtually all of you touch on it, and just yes or no. Do you believe nicotine is not addictive?
I believe nicotine is not addictive, yes.
Mr. Johnston.
Congressman, cigarettes and nicotine clearly do not meet the classic definitions of addiction. There is no intoxication.
We'll take that as a no, and again, time is short. If you could just... I think each of you believe nicotine is not addictive. We just would like to have this for the record.
I don't believe that nicotine or our products are addictive.
I believe nicotine is not addictive.
I believe that nicotine is not addictive.
I believe that nicotine is not addictive.
And I too believe that nicotine is not addictive.
And there you have it, with that somewhat staggering claim by the Seven Dwarfs, as they were called, the CEOs of the seven big tobacco companies, claiming they don't believe there's any connection between addiction and nicotine. We're going to have to end it there for this week. Now, we have worked out this is going to be a three-part show or a three-part episode. This part, obviously, today, Sunday the 15th of December, if you're listening to it on the first or, for some people, second day of its publication. We'll follow up on the 22nd of December, and we'll bracket Christmas by playing part three on the 29th. Then we're going to take a one-week break for the holiday season, and we'll be back on the 12th and 19th of January for episode 68, which is the supplementary five Shakespeare's historical plays doing Henry V and Richard III. That'll be me flying solo before Andrew and I return later in January with Frost Nixon. So that's what we've got to look forward to. Now, we should really play some music from the movie itself. So as you can probably hear in the background, the wonderful voice of Lisa Gerrard will see us out, and we'll see you next week for part two.